From West Virginia to Louisiana, Missouri to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve and its impact or lack of impact on our nation's economy is often the topic of intense debate. What is the Fed, and is it really all that important? John Tamney of FreedomWorks is here to discuss. President Trump has nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh to a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with a real story on what happens next. Civil asset forfeiture continues to be a major issue. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is joined by Jared Skorup of the Mackinac Center for a look at the Michigan experience. And Brett Kavanaugh wasn't his first choice for a seat on the Supreme Court, but he is a good choice. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Federal Reserve seeks to control the U.S. economy by setting overnight interest rates and various other mechanisms. But does that really work? John Tamney is director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks. He's also author of the new book, The End of Work. He joins us now to discuss the impact of the Fed. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, before we start talking about the impact or lack thereof of the Federal Reserve, tell us a little bit about what the Fed is. What is the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Reserve System?
What the Fed began as in 1913 was just as a lender of last resort to solvent banks, and that's what's crucial. The Fed began as a way if banks had really good assets on their books but ran into a near-term cash crunch, they had a central bank that banks were members of to go to and borrow money. What we've, of course, seen over the last 100 years, however, is that it's unheard of for a solvent bank to go to the Fed for a loan simply because doing so is an admission of bankruptcy. A well-run bank with good assets can borrow against those assets fairly easily in the actual marketplace. So the Fed has become a lender of last resort to insolvent banks, thus weakening the banking system. And so since then, of course, its mandate has evolved. It's charged with managing inflation, which it can't realistically do based on its belief that economic growth is what causes inflation, which just isn't true. And so the Fed keeps discovering new things. Now it regulates banks, which it's quite terrible at, and presumes to set the short rate at which banks lend to one another overnight, which is wholly superfluous. And so, for me, I don't worry much about the Fed, but I think we vastly overrate what it can do in the first place.
When you talk about the setting of rates, of course, it seems like the media and the whole financial world just fixates, is the Fed going to raise its rate by a basis point, or is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? There's a lot of fixation on that. Is that fixation really warranted?
Oh, I don't think so at all. Let's, for one, remember that the Fed projects its interest rate influence through the U.S. banking system, which is in rapid decline as a total source of credit. Most lending, and this was true when the Fed began, occurs well away from the banking system. Banks at present represent 15% of total lending. That number's in decline simply because most financing occurs away from banks that are somewhat dated in their approach to finance. More broadly, the Fed had its target rate at close to zero for, I think, a couple of years. Does anyone think credit was cheap? In Silicon Valley, it was so expensive during that time that if you want, and this is true today, if you want to fund a business there, you're going to give up a big portion of it to venture capitalists, and then you're going to give up even more in stock options to employees. In Hollywood, the best producers there freely acknowledge that they're turned down 90% of the time. But when he was a private citizen, Donald Trump was not even touched by U.S. banks. So bad was his credit with a lot of U.S. banks. That's not a political statement. It's just fact that they wouldn't lend to him at all altogether. And so this notion that the Fed is making credit cheap by decreeing a rate zero is as naive as assuming that we could make apartments cheap in New York City just by decreeing them their cost $100 a month. There'd be lots of demand for apartments, but no apartments.
John, also when when we talk about inflation, the Fed is always striving to try to, quote, keep inflation under control. Does it even have that ability?
Of course not, because the Fed doesn't control the dollar's value. There's this myth that persists to this day that the Fed, since it began, that the dollar has plummeted in value and that the Fed's been the cause. But you talk to any Fed official and they'll state the obvious. That's not what they do. They don't control the dollar's exchange rate. So when people make that correlation, they're making a false one. The reality is the Fed was formed in 1913. The first devaluation was in 1933. FDR decided to do it. Fed Chair Eugene Meyer resigned over FDR's decision, so against it was he. Fast forward to 1971. Arthur Burns, the Fed Chair at the time, begged the Nixon administration to not delink the dollar from gold, which was the Nixon administration's way of creating inflation, and the administration rebuffed Burns. Presidents get the dollar they want. The way that you can control inflation is by stabilizing the dollar's value in terms of something real. Historically, we used gold until 1971. The Fed does not control the dollar's exchange rate, so the notion that it can control inflation is rooted in this falsehood that money supply is the driver of inflation, which it's not. And in the Fed's case, it's rooted in the Fed's mistaken view that economic growth causes inflation, which gets things 100% backwards.
So in the end, John, is the Fed even worth having? And hypothetically, if it disappeared tomorrow, would it really make that much difference?
Oh, it wouldn't make much difference at all. Because let's remember, what does the Fed do? It sets a target rate for overnight lending among banks. Well, an interest rate's a price like any other. We don't need the Fed for that. The Fed is a regulator of banks? Well, what a laugh. I mean, the people who work at the Fed couldn't get jobs at banks in the first place. And as we saw in 2008, they didn't have a clue about the problems brewing within banks. Well, we don't need the Fed for that. The Fed is a lender of last resort to banks? Well, what we see is the solvent ones, which is the only banks that should be, that we'd theoretically be propped in the first place, they would never go to the Fed for a loan. It's unheard of. And so the Fed serves no useful purpose. Its only purpose is as a convenient whipping boy for Congress. Congress and presidents can always say, oh, well, the economy's weak because the Fed played around with an interest rate on the just utterly fallacious assumption that the Fed's interaction with a target rate somehow impacts what is a global price. It's amazing how many economists the Fed employs and how many economists are employed based on this utter falsehood that the Fed is important. But all we have to see that it isn't is to imagine if it and the dollar didn't exist. Again, we would still have money in the U.S. It just wouldn't be money issued by the U.S. Treasury. We'd still have abundant credit simply because when you borrow money, you're borrowing access to resources, trucks, tractors, computers, desk chairs. That wouldn't suddenly disappear without the Fed. The Fed is wholly superfluous, yet we keep elevating it. We keep giving it an unwarranted prestige that if anyone stopped to think about it, they'd say, why would we, do we even contemplate these guys?
We have been talking with John Tamney, who is director of the Freedom Work Center for Economic Freedom. He's also author of the new book, The End of Work. John, tell us a little bit about Freedom Works, about the book, and where can folks go to get it?
Well, Freedom Works is a wonderful organization that is trying to change how politicians act. We feel that if we can get more limited government-focused politicians elected in Washington, that we have a better chance of controlling the policy narrative, of keeping it more focused and on limiting the role of government. As far as The End of Work, it's my latest book. It's a very optimistic book that makes the basic case that as the economy grows, more and more people are freed from work that they despise and are able to do work that they love uncontrollably. You can find my work at realclearmarkets.com. You can find it on the Freedom Works website. I'm on Twitter at John Tamney, and look forward to hearing from all of you.
John Tamney of Freedom Works. John, thanks for being back with us.
Loman, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has been, as always, keeping an eye on what's going on in Washington, D.C. It certainly has been an historic and eventful week. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Of course, the big story, Andy, President Trump has nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh to a vacant seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. The left is freaking out. The right, for the most part, applauding, but let's talk for just a minute, Andy. Now that the president has made his nomination to the court, what happens next?
The circus begins. You're going to have Judge Kavanaugh go to the Hill and have meetings with senators one-on-one. Then, of course, you're going to have his testimony in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've seen reports that suggest that the last couple of nominations to go through the Senate, if you don't count Merrick Garland, the Obama's last pick, who never got confirmed, the average time is about 66 days. And I've heard Senate Republican leaders confirm that that's about how long they want it to take. So we could see this go on through July, August, and then sometime in mid-September, the hope is to have Kavanaugh confirmed. Now, what's interesting is that already we've heard positive comments from two Senate Republicans, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who are the most likely to oppose his nomination if they were intent to do so. And they have said positive things about him. So I suspect, barring any surprises, that Republicans could be unified in their support for him. And as you know, with McCain out, Republicans have a 50-49 advantage over Democrats, which is just all they need in order to confirm him.
So Republicans appear to be rather united on this. There was a bit of criticism from some on the right, largely rooted in the fact that Judge Kavanaugh had worked in the W. Bush White House, although that really has no bearing on his judicial record. But Andy, from a pro-growth point of view, is Judge Kavanaugh a good selection?
Yes, he is. And I think there were some earlier concerns about him, and they may have some merit. But remember that his name was picked out of a list of 25 judges that already went through a pretty vigorous vetting process. So I think that he's going to have appeal for the entire Republican Party. Now, let me mention the Democrats, though, for a moment. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has basically signaled that he's going to make this a huge defining issue. And even though this whole process is going to be a political event for the Democrats, I think they're going to use it to spur Democrat voters in November, because what they want to do, even though I don't think it's logical or rational, is that they want to suggest that if Kavanaugh gets nominated, then Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that basically legalized abortion, will get overturned. And even though abortion is not our issue, this is something that's going to dominate this whole process. And what's more is that Schumer is basically signaling that when Kavanaugh gets in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, this is sort of a non-eventful event. What happens every time you have a judge come up for testimony for a Supreme Court nomination, the members of the committee will ask the nominee how they feel about these issues. And the canned response has always been, I will follow precedents. I will follow the letter of the law. And so they never reveal their true political philosophy. And Schumer has already said that that will be unacceptable to the Democrats when Kavanaugh does that. Now, they don't have the votes to stop him, but they are going to make a spectacle of this. And I think it's going to be something that will motivate their base.
The flip side is, and I've already seen some anecdotal evidence to this, is that the Republican base, which has been largely complacent since the election of Donald Trump, seems to be animated by the pick as well. So it could portend a very active election season as we head through October into the November election. Another issue that took a very unusual step, actually, in Congress this past week has to do with President Trump, his imposition of tariffs. What happened in the Senate?
There is a concern that Trump is overstepping his boundaries as the president. And for a moment, it's worth talking about this, not in partisan terms, whether it's Republican or Democrat. I think what's important here is to talk about the separation of powers. Trump has the ability under Section 232 of the Trade Act of 1962 to impose tariffs if he believes that there's a national security concern. And what a national security concern is largely undefined or at the discretion of the president. What the vote that occurred earlier this week did was say, wait a minute, before a president, any president, imposes tariffs that could have obviously huge repercussions on the economy and geopolitics, before those tariffs are imposed, Congress should have a say, similar to before the president as commander-in-chief can commit troops to an area. We once believed that Congress should declare war before we get involved in an international conflict. The same logic applies here, is before the president invokes national security as a reason to oppose tariffs, Congress should have a say in that. And so basically this vote said Congress wants to reassert its authority, and so they had this vote. And it's non-binding, but it passed the Senate 88-11. So I think it's very clear that what Trump has been doing regarding some of his tariffs is that the Senate, and I believe the Congress at large, is uncomfortable with him doing this unilaterally. So it was a good sign for him. I think it's a good, healthy sign for constitutional politics and the separation of powers, because there may be a president in the future who may go even further with this. So I think it's a healthy thing, and hopefully we'll make some more progress on it.
Well, it is always good to have a healthy debate over major economic moves as well as international ones. We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
As always, Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Over $13 million in assets were forfeited by Michigan residents involved in crimes large and small. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Jared Skurup of the Mackinac Center.
Civil asset forfeiture is the process by which the police, the government, can take your property, take your money, take even your house or your car because they think it may have been involved in a crime. But the catch is that they don't usually have to prove that it was involved in a crime, and so it kind of reverses everything we've come to expect about the way the justice system should operate. Instead of innocent until proven guilty, with civil asset forfeiture, you're often guilty until proven innocent. Hi, folks. This is Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest this week is Jared Skurup. He is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Michigan, and he is going to join us in just a second to talk about a new report out of the Wolverine State looking at just how common civil asset forfeiture is. And this is actually a pretty important development because there are a lot of these anecdotal stories about civil asset forfeiture that you see pop up from time to time in the media, but there are very few states that actually require tracking of asset forfeiture in the aggregate, giving you the big picture, the whole picture of how often police departments use this very powerful and often unchecked power. And so being able to summarize all this information in one report is significant, and it does help reformers as they try to get states to stop abusing civil asset forfeiture laws. So, Jared, we appreciate you being here. Thanks for taking some time and joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me here.
The bad news here is that Michigan took money and property from more than 1,000 people last year using civil asset forfeiture. But I guess the good news is at least we know that. We have that data now.
Yeah, it actually might be even worse than that. So it was about 1,000 people who were either not even charged with criminal activity or who had been charged but were found innocent. So last year in Michigan, we know from our new report that there were a little bit more than 6,000 cases of forfeiture. And in about half of those, the forfeiture happened, the actual transfer over to the government happened without a person being convicted of criminal activity. But a lot of those cases were ones where they might still be going through the process. Of course, in our eyes, that's still illegitimate. You should get the criminal conviction prior to the forfeiture. But I like to point to that number of about 1,000 people because those are the people that there wasn't even enough there that they could charge them with anything.
Jared, so often one of the responses that you hear from law enforcement about this is they say that, well, you know, we need to have asset forfeiture. We need to use this tool because people are going to sell drugs and they're going to take the money from those drug sales and they're going to put that money into assets. They're going to buy cars with it. They're going to buy other valuable items with it, and that we need to be able to remove those assets from, you know, we need to be able to take away the benefits of selling drugs. So much of this civil asset forfeiture issue is tied up in the broader federal drug war. Do we have any idea from the Michigan data just how much of this, just how often it is the result of the drug war that people in Michigan are having their property seized by the police?
These law enforcement agencies have to cite some type of criminal statute for the forfeiture. More than 90% of them are drug-related, or they cite drug-related statutes. But of course, that could mean a lot of different things. It could be this person's in the vicinity of an area that does drugs. It could mean that they were at a party or something where other people had drugs, and so we seized their vehicle. Just citing the statute doesn't necessarily mean they were involved in that criminal activity.
Yeah, and certainly if somebody is doing something illegal, take them to court, prove that they were doing something illegal, and then I've got no problem with you seizing their car or their money or whatever it may be, but go prove that they actually committed a crime first. That seems pretty reasonable to me. We're talking with Jared Skorup. He's the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Mackinac Center in Michigan, talking about this new state-produced report on civil asset forfeiture. And Jared, I want to just talk about kind of in a meta way this report, because Michigan is one of only a few states that has this kind of a reporting requirement, and this is a relatively new thing. I think it's only 2 or 3 years now that Michigan has been doing this, and this kind of changes the discussion a little bit, or maybe tell us a bit about how this changes the discussion on civil asset forfeiture, where you can say, look, it's not just these small anecdotal incidents that you hear about from time to time, but it really is this systemic, it's a big picture kind of issue when you're talking about 1,000 people in a year that are affected by this.
I've been working on this issue for about 5 years, and 5 years ago, the Mackinac Center began teaming up with the ACLU chapter here in Michigan. And 5 years ago, we had a bill that was just transparency, and we couldn't even get a hearing on it. I mean, most of the response from lawmakers was, we could get an overall number of how much this is happening. Why do we need this? Sure, there's some anecdotes out there. But we were able to get that report. So this is the second year of the report coming through because of legislation we passed. And the numbers are pretty similar year to year. Last year was about 700 people who were not charged with criminal activity or were found innocent and had assets forfeited. This year it's about 1,000. But the overall numbers of the total worth of the assets is pretty similar. We're not just talking about a couple of anecdotes.
Yeah, and that is what I think really makes this one of the worst abuses of the criminal justice system, is the fact that you can have police go in somewhere and say, well, we found drugs here. We don't know whether this is legal or not, but we're not even going to bother investigating it. We're going to just take your money, take your property anyway, and good luck getting it back. And as I said at the beginning, it really does flip around the entire notion of innocent until proven guilty. But it is the people at the Mackinac Center and people at other state level organizations like the Mackinac Center from coast to coast that are doing a great job of highlighting these abuses and forcing states to at least acknowledge that it's happening, for one, put together these reports to make everything more transparent, and then also going after and reforming these laws, these laws that are very much a violation of the way the justice system should work in this country. So Jared, we very much appreciate the work that you guys are doing at Mackinac, and appreciate you taking some time here on the show to tell us about it.
Thank you, Eric.
And again, that is Jared Skorup. He's the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Michigan. You can check out more of their work at mackinac.org. You can check out our coverage of civil asset forfeiture from coast to coast at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh wasn't the most conservative of the choices available to President Trump, but on this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says he nonetheless is a good choice. Colin?
Judge Brett Kavanaugh wasn't my ideal choice to replace Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court, but I think he's the right choice. That's because my ideal choice would have been a brilliant, unambiguously pro-life, and ideologically conservative woman like Amy Coney Barrett, who has an additional advantage in being the youngest and thus potentially longest serving of all the top candidates for the High Court. However, she would be the wrong choice if she were unacceptable to either one of the two Republican senators who support abortion rights and Planned Parenthood, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. With Senator McCain sidelined with brain cancer and unlikely to be able to come to Washington for the vote, the loss of either one of those two would likely result in a defeat for President Trump's nominee, requiring a much longer process that could easily extend beyond the November election and running the risk of total defeat if Republicans were to lose their Senate majority. Both Senators Collins and Murkowski have signaled what Politico magazine calls comfort with Kavanaugh. They had earlier signaled some discomfort with Barrett, and that could make all the difference, even though the average observer might miss the point. Here's why. If Democrats knew for certain that even one Republican senator were to oppose the president's nominee, then the political value of denying him his nominee would outweigh whatever jeopardy it might place any of the several Democratic senators running for re-election in states that Trump won. But if all 50 votes for Judge Kavanaugh are secure on the Republican side, then you will probably see several Democrats join the 50 Republicans and vote for Kavanaugh. This could result in Kavanaugh garnering as many as 53, 54, or even 55 votes. The average observer would see a 55 to 44 vote for Kavanaugh as a clear-cut bipartisan vote when, in fact, it would be nothing of the sort. Once the 50 Republican votes appear secure, then the ever-wily Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer will release any Democratic senators from strict partisan solidarity and let them vote in favor of their own reelection. A 55 to 44 vote would probably, in reality, only be a 50 to 49 vote, with five vulnerable Democrats casting save-their-skins votes so that Schumer would have a better chance of becoming Senate Majority Leader. Two respected conservative votes on the right, the American Family Association and Fox News judicial analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano, have actually spoken in opposition to Kavanaugh. What's that all about? While I wouldn't want to suggest that either one was insincere, I do think that their statements of disapproval help Kavanaugh appear more moderate. That could help Collins and Murkowski turn their stated comfort into genuine support. The Senate is an unusual institution. A lot of what seems to be one thing is really another. The final vote on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination is likely to be seen as a wide victory for the president, when in fact it's probably as narrow as 50 to 49. A more appealing candidate on ideological grounds could well go down to defeat. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is the right choice at this moment in political time. If a third Supreme Court seat opens in Trump's first terms, and if Republicans hold their majority in the Senate this November, Amy Coney Barrett could win that confirmation battle, but probably not this one, which is why the ideal choice isn't always the right choice. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXEX-AM in Fresno, California, KTRU-FM in La Harpe, Kansas, along with WENG-AM in Englewood, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.